Monsieur le Président, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen. First, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference. It's an honor and a pleasure to be able to give a talk here. The topic of my talk, you heard it before, is a questionnaire. The results of a questionnaire which was organized by the network of the presidents of the Supreme Judicial Court of the European Union. At that time, I was president of the network, and that's the reason why I was invited. Thank you. This questionnaire focused on the state of the play of judicial expert unions in the European Union. And its results, which I'm going to present to you, its results can be summarized in 8 questions. First question, who can be appointed as expert? Who chooses the expert? Who defines the expert's mission? What are the expert's duties and tasks? Does the court, the judge, control the progress of the expert's work? Are there formal requirements for the report? Is it safeguarded, a very important point, is it safeguarded that the party's right to be heard is respected? And last point, how and by whom is the expert remunerated? You know this saying, who pays the piper calls the tune, wer zahlt schafft an, we say in German. Therefore, it's a very important question. Before discussing these questions and presenting you the results, I would like to clarify a few fundamental points. The first distinction we have to make is the distinction between expert and witness. We all know that in most or in all continental codes of procedure, experts are mentioned among the means of evidence. And that is quite strange, because the expert plays another role. He's not just a means of evidence. What is now the main difference between an expert and a witness? The expert ascertains facts. An expert has to be appointed if the judge lacks the necessary scientific or technical knowledge to ascertain what really happened. And that's the most important second part of the expert's work, the expert is expected and allowed, that's a difference to the witness, he is allowed to draw conclusions on the basis of the facts he or she has ascertained, of the facts that are available and relevant. On the other hand, the witness provides evidence. The witness has to state what he or she has seen or has heard, has to present to the court his or her perception of certain occurrences or what had happened. A second important distinction between expert and witness is that in most continental jurisdiction, the expert may be and in fact often is appointed by the court ex officio. And that's an understandable rule, because the judge feels and knows that he or she lacks the necessary expertise, and therefore he or she decides to appoint an expert. That's also the main difference between the common law jurisdictions and the continental jurisdiction. It's changing a little bit now in England, for example, but that was the main difference, that the court ex officio can appoint an expert. The judge may have an assistant. When often, for example, the expert is called an auxiliary of the judge. He has a public function. The relationship between expert and court is not governed by private law, but it is governed by public law. Though he has a particular position in the court proceedings, he's close to the judge. In our Code of Procedure in Austria, we have a provision that enables the court to call or summon witnesses, also those who are not suggested by the parties. Such a provision is sometimes found also in other codes of procedure, but very rarely it's used. Judges are very hesitant to summon a witness who is not suggested by the parties. And I think the reason behind is that witnesses are polarized. So people speak of my witness, your witness, but in the continental systems, we don't speak of my expert, your expert. That's the case in the United States, for example. But here, expert evidence is not polarized, whereas witness evidence is polarized. We have two main types of judicial experts. Court-appointed experts, as I said, an auxiliary of the court, an assistant of the court, and party-appointed experts. It's quite clear that every party is free to appoint an expert every time if they need the specific knowledge of an expert. That's often done before a claim is raised, an action is brought, just to find out what the facts are. But, and that's the main difference to the court-appointed expert, this party-appointed expert doesn't figure in our codes of procedure. He's not mentioned, except in Sweden and in the Netherlands, what came out also in this questionnaire, in this survey. In all other countries, if there's a party-appointed expert, and if he or she renders an opinion, this opinion can be brought into the proceedings, but it's just documentary evidence. And it's the only value of such a private, as we call it, a Privatgutachten in German, a private expert opinion, the only value is that it proves that the person who signs this document holds this view. That's very little. And I will come back to this party-appointed expertise because they play an important role in connection with the question how parties are in a situation or how they are able to oppose the findings of a court-appointed expert. The questionnaire I'm talking about focused on court-appointed experts and did not deal specifically also with party-appointed experts. If we now speak about expert evidence in civil proceedings, we have court-appointed expert, we have expert witnesses, and now what's the difference between court-appointed experts and expert witnesses? We have expert witnesses in the United States where each party looks for an expert, has an expert, and presents this expert as an expert witness, as a star witness, as is called in this report you find in your papers, in court. This system has the great drawback or disadvantage that there's a danger of a lack of objectivity. Because it's quite clear that the party will only appoint an expert witness and bring an expert witness into court if this expert shares the party's views, of course, otherwise it would be senseless. So in the United States, there often is a kind of expert shopping. Advocates look for an expert who really says what they want him to say. Though it's a very low degree, can be a very low degree objectivity. And there are also mixed systems. It's now in England, where one tries to combine the advantages of both systems, court-appointed expert, a guarantee of high objectivity, expert witnesses, it is safeguarded that the party's right to be heard is respected, and these two cornerstones combined can lead to a mixed system. I will come back to it later. What is now the philosophy behind this institution of a court-appointed expert? The philosophy behind it is that there is a duty of the judge to establish the facts truthfully. It was first laid down in the Austrian Court of Civil Procedure, which dates back to 1895. And the author of this Court of Civil Procedure, Franz Klein, was disgusted by the adversarial system because he thought it's much too costly. It prevents people from having access to court. And he called this system a war without a red cross. And I thought it's in the best interest of society to have substantive law enforced. And the best way to have substantive law enforced is to get to decisions which are based on true facts. And therefore, it's the duty of the judge to establish the true facts. This concept presupposes an active judiciary, whereas the Anglo-American system, and now the English system had a little bit changed, but the system of the US-American federal courts is based on the notion that the parties have a central role in the gathering and presentation of evidence. And the judge may lean back and wait what is presented to him or to her, and then come to a judgment. So it's another concept. And the thought behind is that in the party's interest to find out what really happened. Those people who are really interested do their job. So these are the other system and adversarial procedure. Now, I come to the questions underlying this questionnaire. And now I would like to give you a short overview. I won't present you the results in detail. I think all of you have got the questionnaire, so you can read it. In most countries, courts keep lists of qualified experts. In some countries, that's laid down by law. In other countries, it's just considered good practice. But it's clear it's practically if you have a list of people who seem to be qualified to work, to be appointed as experts. And here we can distinguish two procedures. Some countries have a real approval procedure where it is checked whether a person who wants to be registered as an expert has the necessary competence. And we have also countries where there is a simple enrollment procedure. People are registered if they want to be registered, but there is not a specific controlling of their competence. This verification of the expert's qualities is often assigned to mixed juries consisting of academics, of other experts, and also consisting of judges. And university degree is in those states where there is such an approval procedure not sufficient. An expert needs to have also practical experience. This listing of an expert is usually subject to renewal. And it depends, there are different models. There was one country where this renewal procedure takes place every year, but in most countries it's every 5 years. And in order to have the listing renewed, the experts must prove what they have done in these 5 years or in the time before, whether they have rendered opinions, in which cases, though that there is a certain examination of their qualification, and that the court keeping the list, or the institution sometimes the list kept by the Ministry of Justice, can be sure that the expert is still qualified. It would be an important task of judges to inform this Ministry of Justice or the court who keeps the list when they make bad experiences with experts. Because it lies in the vital interest of judges that the persons who are registered are really qualified. And really qualified means, from the point of view of a judge, really qualified means not only to possess the scientific knowledge, the technical knowledge. Really qualified as a court expert means to be able to work timely, to render your opinion within that period of time which was set in your case. And it must also be, an expert must also be able to express what he has found in a language which is understandable for the judge. Because the judge should be put in a position to understand it and to be able to check it, whether it's really logical. So the expert must have qualifications as a court expert which go beyond just mere technical or scientific knowledge. Since there are lists of experts kept by courts, and since there are experts mostly chosen among listed experts, of course there is a problem: what is with an expert who is who is not registered in one country, but he wants to testify as an expert in this country? Can he just be refused because he's not listed here? And in the Benararoya case of the Court of Justice, the Court of Justice held that there must a possibility for the person to prove his or her qualification, that such a list must not be exclusive. The decision is about translators, but I'm quite sure it must be the same for all other experts. What now about the responsibility of experts, which is very, very important? This predominant role of experts in a case. You sometimes hear it from parties. It's often a fear of parties that the case is decided by the expert and not by the judge. And sometimes judges tend to give the decision-making power to the expert. Therefore, it's very important that the expert is feels bound by ethic rules. Most countries, therefore, have codes of conduct for experts, and also in all countries, there is also civil liability and sometimes also criminal liability for experts who infringe their duties of being impartial and unbiased. In Austria, we have had a long discussion whether there should be state liability for court-appointed experts. So far, we don't have it because the Ministry of Justice is strongly against it. But why did this question come up? Particularly in cases which are highly emotionalized, like childcare cases, for example. Sometimes also cases about visiting rights. There is a tendency for the losing party to sue the expert. And experts in Austria were confronted with claims for damages. And that leads to, it has consequences, because very good qualified expert says, I don't want to do it anymore. I get, it's not well paid. I get a little money for it, and I'm in danger of being sued in court because the other party is not satisfied with my opinion. If there would be state liability, then this danger would be minimized, because there could be then an action from the state against the expert, but it's not very likely that it may happen. But so far, we don't have state liability for expert, which is somewhat strange, because the expert, the court-appointed expert, has a kind of public function. So it would be logically also to say there's state liability. Now, important question, who chooses the expert? In most continental systems, it's the judge who chooses the expert. And usually the judge enjoys a broad discretion. The lists only provide information, so the judge is not prevented from appointing somebody who is not listed. This question of whether and whom to choose an expert has also great ethical implications for a judge. Because if an expert is appointed, that means it's costly and it takes time. And therefore, the judge has to consider all facts, all elements of the case, whether it's really necessary to appoint an expert, and not just seek to be relieved from his task. Just to then, if he gets a complicated case, first reaction is, oh, I have to appoint an expert. I send the file to the expert, and the expert should answer my question, which is sometimes formulated in this way, is the claim justified or is it not justified? So that's not a good way to deal with it. But it should be that the judge should really find out what are the controversial issues and where can an expert opinion really be of value. In some countries, the judge is bound if the parties agree on a certain expert, for example, in Germany, not in Austria. Also, if both parties want a certain person to be appointed as an expert, the judge is not obligated to follow. So the judge is always free whom to appoint. Who defines the mission? A most important stage in the proceedings, and in all countries it's the judge who defines the mission, and usually, and that's good practice, after the judge has heard the parties. In some countries there's a formalized procedure. In other countries, as for example in Austria, for reasons of flexibility, the judge is entirely free how he or she defines the mission. That, as I mentioned before, is dangerous, because sometimes judges tend not to really think about it and to think through it, to really find out what are the crucial issues. That has to be done, and it's also a task of the courts of appeal to take it and to advise lower courts that they have to do it, because a lot of money is spent in such cases. Time goes by, and therefore it's a very important task of the judge to exactly define what the expert is expected to do. What are now the expert's duties? Of course, this predominant position of the expert in the court proceedings makes it necessary that the court, that the expert, like the judge, is unbiased, that he is impartial, because he has this important function, and that the expert must enable both parties to participate on an equal footing in the production of the report. And this goes back to a judgment of the European Court of Human Rights, Mandovanelli versus France, where the European Court of Human Rights held in a 5-4 judgment that Article 6 was violated because the claimants in this case had no possibility to, for example, cross-examine the persons who had given information to the expert, information on which the expert had based his expertise, his expert opinion. It was a case involving medical malpractice. The claimants were of opinion that their daughter had died, that there was negligence on part of the hospital, and the expert came to the conclusion that there was no negligence. The French courts, they said there was no obligation to have a second opinion, and the European Court of Human Rights ruled that there should have been a second opinion because the parties had not been in a position to really participate in the production of the report. Usually the expert has to give a written report, and there are no rules how the report has to be made, but it's quite clear, and that's case law, for example, in Austria, that there has to be a clear distinction between the facts stated by the expert and by the conclusions he or she draws. And the expert is not allowed to speak about legal consequences, because that's not the expert's task. But that's case law. There are not rules to that effect. Most countries have no specific form. In most cases, the parties may request that the expert also testifies in court, that he answers additional questions, gives clarifications, but it can also be ordered by the court that the expert participates in a hearing and that he explains his written report. There was also a question, what happens between appointing the expert, defining his or her mission, and rendering the opinion? What does the court do in this period in between? And the answer is wait. Wait for the opinion in most countries, but the court has to make sure that the expert complies with the time limit. Expert opinions are one of the major causes for very long proceedings, for undue delays, because often it's the case that the most qualified experts a judge wants to have as an expert are very, very busy, and it takes time to get the opinion. But the court has to monitor in this respect and has to urge the expert to file his opinion. And that's also a very important task of the court. The court has to safeguard that the expert can fulfill his task, and that means the expert often needs the cooperation of the parties. The expert needs documents. He must be able to inspect the site, for example, and therefore the parties must be willing to make this possible and to hand over documents. And if they refuse to do so, the expert can turn to the judge, and then the judge the court has to order the parties to comply with the expert requests. But the parties for sure have the possibility to evoke privileges, for example, of if they have a lawyer, for example, is not allowed to speak about certain details he has learned from his client. And then, if such privileges are invoked, also in medical malpractice cases, for example, in such cases, the court has to decide whether it is justified. The court has to balance the conflicting interests and to order the production of the evidence or to say, no, it's not necessary. That's one of the most important points. And it's very interesting to see that there is a real difference within the continental jurisdictions. The party's right to be heard is highly respected in countries like France. In other southern countries, Romania, for example, according to the questionnaire. And it's less respected in countries like Austria. And I think it's another notion of the expert's role. Since the expert is very close to the judge, you see, the party's right to be heard is not respected in a sufficient extent. I think there has something to be changed. According to this Mantovanelli judgment, there are strict rules that the parties must be able to also participate in the production of the report. And what's the picture now? Now we have this picture that in some countries, like in France, for example, the parties are to be heard every time, that the expert has to discuss with the parties what he's doing, give them the possibility to take part in his findings, and in other countries, like in Austria, this right is respected only ex post when the report is already finished. That it's less effective is quite clear. Once the report is ready, it's difficult to change it. Also for the expert, he has stated what he thinks, and it's always difficult for a person to change it. A very important question is, do parties have a right to a second opinion? Because sometimes that's the only way out. If it's the findings of the expert are negative for a party's position, often he or she tries to oppose it with a second opinion or with the opinion of an expert appointed by said party. There is one decision of the Court of Justice to its Stephenson, and in this decision the Court of Justice held that there may be cases where that's the only way to really ensure that the party can defend his or her position is a second opinion. It was a case about the quality of foodstuff. And there the Court of Justice held there might be a right to a second opinion, and the court should have given the possibility. What is now an effect of an expert opinion? Here's a very harmonious picture. In all countries, the court is free to evaluate the finding of the expert. He is not bound by it, but the court has a duty to weigh the conclusions against other evidence. A very interesting and an important question is whether the court is also obligated to weigh the findings of the court-appointed experts to the findings of the party-appointed experts. Whether in his reasoning he has to say something about it, and there we have a difference. Whereas in some countries, that's the duty of the court, in Austria it's not. So if there is an opinion from a party-appointed expert, a Privatgutachten, the And there's also an opinion of a court-appointed expert. There's no need for the judge to say anything about it, which is not a good situation. Because this expertise, this private expertise, is often the only means of the party to oppose the findings of the court-appointed expert. There should be given possibility, or at least the court should be obligated to deal with it. Remuneration of experts in most countries that's fixed by the judge, which is quite clear, it's a public office the expert has. The judge may order deposit and also a payment on account. In most countries, that it has to be found out beforehand how much the expert opinion will cost. And there's also a duty, an expert's duty of warning the court if his or her costs will be higher. And then the court must have the possibility to stop it. And if the expert does not warn the court, he doesn't get what he wants in addition. We had in our court such cases where the expert then didn't get it because he had not warned the court. In most countries, the costs of the expert form part of the cost of the proceedings, and therefore they have to be borne by the losing party, which is not entirely logical, one could say, because why was the expert appointed? Because the judge lacked the necessary knowledge. The one could also say, therefore, it has to be borne by the state or by the Minister of Justice, because we need to have qualified judges. But that's perhaps an illusion, especially in days as we have them now, with very small state budgets. It's not possible for the state to cover everything, but in Lithuania, for example, the only country, the fees of experts are borne by the Justice Department. In our country, for example, in childcare cases, also borne by the states, or if there's legal aid. Now, what can be the conclusions? I think that now we have systems in Europe which are quite similar, but we have some differences. And if we think where then harmonization should take place, I would like to mention cornerstones, which in my opinion should be respected in such a system. The most important cornerstone is the right to a fair trial. And that means that an expert must be unbiased and impartial. And it must be made sure that the expert really has this quality. The parties must be able to challenge an expert if they think that he's biased or partial. Both parties must be able to participate on an equal footing in the production of the expert's report. I also think this is indispensable, because once a report is finished, it's very difficult to oppose it. And therefore, the parties must have the possibility to take part in the findings, in the ascertaining of facts of the expert. What has to be avoided? A system must make sure that there is not a delegation of the decision-making of the expert. Experts stand in this court-centered systems. Experts stand to be very, very powerful. And judges sometimes stand to minimize their work. So, therefore, it must be made sure that parties can oppose the findings of the expert by means, for example, of a party-appointed expert. Therefore, these private expert opinions should have to be taken into consideration by the court when giving reasons for the judgment. And I think that such a harmonized system should be based on the principle that both the court and the parties should be actively involved in matters of expertise. That what we need is some form of cooperation between the court of the parties. And I think that a mixed system, like it's now in England, for example, with a single joint expert, could be an answer. Not this court-centered approach we have had up to now, not the expert-witness approach, but something in between, which respects part